session number 27073, Reel 3.
Billy J, Reel 3. So how did you come to convert onto the Hurricane? What was the method you used?
Yeah, well, I was sent up to Brooklands to pick up a Hurricane. Met an old chum of mine who's a test pilot by the name of Dickie Reynolds. And I said, have you got any dual airplanes? I know you haven't. Have you got any? How are we going to convert to these things? He says, the same way as I did. I'll show you where the petrol is. I'll show you and the stalling speed is. I said, thanks, Dickie. He says, well, there we are. Strap yourself in. Now, don't forget, stalling speed is 85 or whatever it was. And that's the petrol system. There's the undercarriage. That's the flap. That's it. The best of luck to you. That was my conversion.
How did you feel about that at the time? Would you be nervous about doing that?
No. That was quite normal because we didn't have any dual Hurricanes or dual Spitfires, and that was the only way to convert. It was somebody you trusted would tell you what are the basic things that you've got to find out before you find out for yourself. What is its stalling speed and where's the petrol system?
Was there anything else new about the Hurricane that maybe had not been in the Fury?
Oh, yes. But again, it was all relevant that it was an aeroplane, but in this case, just one set of wings instead of two. It had an engine in front and petrol system, which you had to know, and an hydraulic system, which you should know. And you also had a thing called pilot's notes, which you could read at your leisure. And this is what we did. We read the pilot's notes, then we went up. And for the first 3 or 4 months in the squadron, we did nothing else but convert ourselves onto that aeroplane.
Obviously, flying the Furies, they didn't have a retractable undercarriage. Cause any problems with anybody at all?
No, none at all, no.
It was just another thing to remember?
Just another thing, yeah.
Coming in.
I mean, the thing is that the two methods of remembrance, one was you could write it down, what your procedure would be before takeoff, at landings, etc., etc., or you had it all in your head. In my case, it was all in my head.
And you just drilled yourself over that three-month period
that's
to
right.
get that in.
And there wasn't all that amount.
What were your impressions of the Hurricane?
I liked it. It was the first modern aeroplane. It was an aeroplane that one could go to war in, against the German Air Force, against the 109s and the Dorniers, etc., etc. So you had a fair chance of, and of course you had all those guns. And there was quite a, and you had a thing called a gyro gun sight, which helped you to, on deflection shooting, etc., etc. It was a great aeroplane, and the more you flew it, the more you had respect for it.
How did that gyro gun sight work?
I still don't know.
I was going to ask, actually, because it obviously had more guns than the Fury. With the Fury, how many guns did you actually have?
You had two. And flying through the prop with a Constantinecto gearing.
And with the squadron, obviously with one squadron, I was going to ask you about some of the people who were in that squadron with you at that time. If I could run through some of them. The squadron leader was Bull Halloran?
At the beginning of the war, yes. Before that was Ferdy Swain, the man I was talking to who did the height record. He was a squadron commander. And then There's another whose name I've forgotten at the moment. He was ex-Navy. And then Bull Hallam took us out to France.
What was he like as a man?
We didn't know him particularly well. As I explained to you, we were a bachelor service. He was a married officer. So we didn't see much of him apart from at squadron level. But he wasn't all that popular.
With the squadron leaders, would they be slightly distant from the squadrons?
Yeah, first of all, which squadron commanders are you talking about? Are you talking about the pre-war squadron commanders who took over at the beginning of the war? They were dyed-in-the-wool senior officers. That was one thing. Then you got the next bunch of squadron commanders who had been flight commanders and who then took over squadrons with a great amount of operation experience behind them. And that was the beginning of the emergence of a very professional Air Force.
Could I take it from that then that the most of the work of actually running the squadron would be the flight commander's role?
Exactly. The flight commanders were the leaders of the young pilots. The only time your squadron commander was involved in any of our flying was if there was a squadron formation display of 12 aeroplanes. Some squadron commanders, pre-war squadron commanders, took their jobs a little more seriously, or not seriously, or got involved in the day-to-day flying problems of the young pilots.
Who were the flight commanders, you remember, at the
start? My two flight commanders at the beginning of the war when we moved to France was Johnny Walker and Prosser Hanks. Both had been in the number one squadron flight aerobatic team under Teddy Donaldson.
And what were they like?
Oh, they were great. They were our age group. They were mates of ours. We had respect. They weren't sirs or anything like that. They were mates of ours, friends. But they were our bosses. And whatever they said we had to do, we did it.
What about other people within the squadron at that time? Who was it?
Oh, I could go through the whole gamut of my mates who were in one squadron. Most of them, well, all of them, apart from myself, is dead now. But as I said, it was a very close-knit family, and we all respected each other. We liked, apart from certain provisos, trying to think of his name, Clisby, for example, I shared a room with, and he was a dyed-in-the-wool Australian, didn't realise that I was half Australian. So for about 6 months, we never spoke to each other. Then we got to know each other, and we were great mates from then onwards. But unfortunately, a lot of them were killed in Battle of France, and we disappeared from each other's things.
There's another person, I think it was in the squadron, who was a friend of yours, Paul Ritchie.
Oh, Paul, yeah. Paul wrote the book called Fighter Pilot. Yeah. You read that, haven't you? Fighter Pilot. Oh, yes, he was. Because both of us were bilingual, and so we used to go on parties together. And he went on more parties than I did, and got to know the French Air Force quite well. And then wrote, I think, one of the best Air Force wartime books called Fighter Pilot, which was based on his day-to-day diary.
Were you strictly allowed to keep a diary?
Oh yes, provided we didn't use names. If you read Fighter Pilot, it's only Christian names that are mentioned. Then later on, you could they rescinded that law.
And also, one of the people I think you flew with at that time was Flying Officer Killy Kilmartin.
Oh, Killy! Well, Killy was my very closest friend, and I got to do, I knew him during the whole of his life, and went to his funeral not so very long ago down here. Yeah.
It was a little bit of a mixture in nationalities, wasn't it, though, that one squadron? Was there a Canadian pilot as well?
We had Canadians. Hilly Brown was a Canadian. Australians, one or two. No, only one. Clisby. Those are the only two foreigners we had, to the best of my knowledge.
And another person I think you mentioned as well was Pussy Palmer.
Oh, Pussy. Pussy was the most extraordinary poker because he smoked air. He smoked cigarettes, and the first time he bailed out in France, he was seen at about 1,000 feet smoking a cigarette before landing. But he was a brilliant aerobatic pilot, for example. But he was a person that one never really got to know. He lived in his own funny little world. But the interesting point about Pussy was that all of us were youngsters. We hadn't any experience of sizing people up. And all of us had sort of ideas of how people would react in wartime. And the one thing I kept on saying to myself, Pussy, how the hell are you ever going to war? Because all you do is smoke bloody cigarettes. And you got your little sports car, and you've got a girlfriend there. But I can't see him. And then he turns out to be one of the most brilliant bloody fighter pilots. So you only in wartime or in emergencies can you really legitimately size anybody up.
One last person that I was thinking of was also Pilot Officer Boy Mould.
Oh, Boy. Boy had... He was an extraordinary chap in that he started off life in the Air Force as a Halton apprentice. And from Halton, he was sent to Cranwell and became a Cranwell cadet and then joined us. Boy... It was a mixture. Again, if one introduces this class distinction, one could see that there's a remnant of class distinction in his thoughts about his brother officers, in that he'd been through the whole gamut, and therefore probably had slight reservations about his mates. But unfortunately, once again, he was killed in Malta before really reaching his apogee of potential.
And I imagine there would have been some NCOs in the squadron as well.
Oh, yes, yes. We had, I think, each flight had about three NCO pilots. One was Darky Clowes. I remember him very well. But again, because their mess life was completely separate from ours, they lived in the sergeant's mess, and we lived where we lived, we didn't get to know them quite as well as we should have, as we did, for example, in the desert, where we had pilots' messes, where all the NCO pilots and the officer pilots were all part of.
You moved to France quite early, didn't you, after the outbreak of war?
Well, I was shot down on the second day of
I was thinking early in 1939, well, late in 1939, but early after the outbreak of war.
Did I leave?
You moved to France from the UK.
Oh, yes. We were part of number 1 Squadron, number 73 Squadron, were the two fighter squadrons, and I think 83 Squadron, I'm not sure, but 1 and 73 were allied together as a part of the Air Strike Force. So we went out as soon after the declaration of war as we could, and I think we moved on the 9th of December, of September, and we went first to a funny airfield, which its predominant feature was a nunnery, which we took over as the officers' mess. The girls all left. But the interesting thing was that our mess where we ate was in Le Havre itself, and we took over a brothel. And two of the girls stayed on as waitresses to look after us as far as our food was concerned. But our first job was to ensure that the troop ships coming into France at Le Havre were looked after.
Had you flown across in your aircraft?
Or yeah, we flew across, and all the ground transport went in a trooper. So we were slightly larger squadron than fighter command squadrons in that we had a certain ancillary tradesmen apart from fitters and riggers.
Did you have a French liaison officer at all?
Yeah, a man called de Mose. Don't know a lot about it. I got to know him quite well. But de Mose was our interpreter. Quite a nice chap. And then we all left one way or the other. I went that way. The squadron went down after the Battle of France started down to Le Mans. And he escaped. And I didn't realize that he'd been a pilot. And he escaped in an aeroplane that he'd picked up to England. And there, joined the Free French and was commissioned and became a well-known fighter pilot. And unfortunately was killed just after the war came to its close.
At that early period, did you have much contact with the French populace?
Not really. The population that we got to know was one particular hotel where we were looked after by the manageress, Madame Jean, who looked after us, and she fed us whenever we wanted to. We had a funny drinking law then in France at the beginning of the war that on certain days there was no liquor. But I can assure you that our tea was heavily laced. And also then we were looked after by the local inhabitants of the village that we lived in. His name I'll remember in a moment. They looked after us. They gave us beds to sleep in, and also looked after our bed warming. Not what you might be thinking, but it was one of the coldest winters that Europe has known for a very long time, and my bed was out in an outhouse in a farm, and the dear old Madame there used to put two hot bricks into my and bung those into my bed, and that was our method of keeping warm.
Did you at that time, would you have had a serviceman to look after your...
No, we didn't have Batman then. As far as I can remember, no, we had no Batman.
What was your daily routine like at that period? Were you were patrolling, I take it, while the rest of the BFS was arriving?
No, you really have to look at the situation that we were in. We had no early warning in France. The French didn't, we didn't. So our control was by a headquarters run by a wing commander, Pemberton, who used to ring us up and say, patrol such and such a area, we think something is brewing, but it was only thinking because we had no information. So most of the operational sorties that were carried out would be the noise of a German type aeroplane. You could tell the difference between the two air forces or the French air forces, and or condensation trails, and we would, if we saw a condensation trail going in the direction of Germany, we'd take off and investigate.
And with that period, did you the first little airfield you're at, with the, where you were accommodated in the nunnery, did you stay there very long, or did you?
No, we were there for about a week. That was all, and then went to. We went to Bazincourt, which is named the airfield, and the name of the town, I've forgotten it, but I'll think, I'll bring it up and I'll think about it.
What type of airfield was Bazincourt?
It's just a grass farm, that was all.
Was it just one squadron, or were there...
Just number one squadron, yeah.
Did you have much contact at that period with the French Air Force?
I didn't, but Paul Ritchie did, because he talked good French.
But there was no kind of official kind of cooperation?
No. I can't make any statement on the French Air Force, but... I don't think they were really prepared for war. Didn't seem like it anyway. And we didn't see them flying around.
At that time, was there any kind of discussion of potentially tactics that you might have to employ should the Germans appear in force?
No. No, we had no... nothing on which to base our opinions. We just got stuck into anything that we saw, period.
Did you have any successes with the squadron between, you know, obviously between September and May?
Yes, I think we had, without looking up the squadron diary, I think one or two of us had an encounter with the German Air Force. My particular one was I saw a condensation trail, went after it, and at about 18,000 feet saw a blue Spitfire, which was a PR Spitfire. And as I was having a look and waving to him, I suddenly looked around and there was a 109 coming at me. So... We fought without shooting our guns, because I can assure you no 109 could have kept up with my turns, panic turns. Anyway, he then broke off, and I followed him, and got down to 0 feet, and he was going for Germany, and I was trying to catch up with him, but couldn't. And then he knew what he was doing. He was leading me into a nice little trap and forced me to fly underneath some high-tension cables over the River Rhine, which meant that the cables were quite high. And then he pulled up to have a look at the mess that he thought he'd see behind. That was his mistake, because I was able to just catch up with him, give him a burst. And to the best of my knowledge, I didn't shoot him down, but I forced him to force land. And that was verified by other sources later on. So that was my first encounter with the German Air Force.
How had the Hurricane performed in that? You said obviously you were making some tight panic turns, but had you felt confident in the aircraft?
Yes, we could turn tighter than they could, but the one thing that they could do, which we couldn't, that was they had direct injection, and therefore they could, if they wanted to get away in a hurry, they could stuff the nose down and the engine wouldn't cut as it would with the Merlins.
Can you tell me what happened on about May the 10th, what your first inklings were that obviously the Germans were attacking in force?
Well, yes, it was sort of a blur, really, because there had been no warning either by the press or by the BBC or anything, or even by our headquarters, that things were brewing up, that Hitler had decided that France was going to be the next target, until we woke up on
May the 10th,
and heard, obviously, hundreds of German airplanes coming across, and it was still dark when we came up to the airfield, when dawn broke, we realized that the Germans were attacking us. They didn't come directly to Wesenkopf, our airfield, but once again, as there was no early warning, all that our headquarters could say was take off and patrol such an area, which we did about four times that particular day. And I don't seem to remember being involved in anything but being bloody frightened. And actually, I'm going to retract that word. I wasn't frightened. I was anticipating. Because the word frightened, I'm often asked whether I was ever, and I always say no, I was never, but that I was apprehensive. So, and so that's the way that particular day ended. One or two of us got a shot at the Germans. And then when it became in the evening, we were told that we'd be moving to a satellite airfield quite near Reims. I've forgotten the name of it. And so the next day we took off first light and landed at... Oh, yes, I seem to remember the name of the Berriobac, that's right. And we landed there and found our digs where we were able to put our stuff in. And then once again, just patrolled certain areas. And then next day...